This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Domino Pizza delivers slavery with a smile.
But first, we're going to take a look at TANF. President Clinton signed the personal responsibility. That name still annoys me no end. Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act.
Ah.
Replacing, indeed, aid to families with dependent children, AFDC, with TANF as the National Welfare Program for Needy Americans. 15 years later, the truth is that TANF has actually shredded the safety net.
And TANF is up for reauthorization. What is likely to happen to TANF, and how do we, in any event, expand, rethread the tattered safety net? Tim Casey, longtime welfare advocate and attorney with Legal Momentum, joins us.
The shredded safety net. But I don't want to just say that. Is indeed that the reality? Is that what 15 years has wrought to the welfare system?
Yes. The 1996 law that President Clinton signed, popularly known as the Welfare Reform Law, it took a welfare program that was already in many ways a very inadequate program and ultimately made it far, far worse. Under welfare reform, the percentage of poor children receiving welfare assistance has dropped from 3 out of 5 poor children to just 1 in 5 poor children. And the average welfare benefit in majority of states is now less than $5 a person a day. So welfare reform, rather than helping needy families, has meant a system that is inaccessible to most poor families and which provides inadequate benefits to the relatively few families who are able to get in the door.
Tim, a lot of people would say that too many people were on welfare, and it's a good thing that welfare rolls have dropped. Why are you so critical of that?
Well, because the drop in the welfare rolls isn't due to an increase in employment or to a decrease in poverty, but rather to a reduction in aid to needy families. If the welfare rolls dropped because employment was rising, because wages were rising, that would be a good thing. That would mean there was less poverty. But that's not been the reality. The reality is that the welfare rolls have dropped because the system has become a series of bureaucratic barriers that keep needy people from getting in the door. And it's always important to remember that the vast majority of welfare recipients are single mothers and their children. And often, if not in most cases, the reason that people turn to the welfare system is because there aren't jobs, or if there are jobs, they don't have the child care they need in order to work.
I just keep thinking of one particular major thing, that the benefit receipt has fallen from 3/5 of poor children pre-reform to just 1/5 of poor children post-reform. And something that you, of course, had mentioned to me, which is that the benefit amounts have plummeted to essentially $5 less than $5 a day in most states.
A person.
That's scandalous. That is just heartbreaking.
Yeah, and the consequence of that is we see it in increased rates of hunger and food insecurity, homelessness, evictions, utility turnoffs. Children who are really unable to participate in social activities into which most children can participate because their parents are simply too poor to allow them to participate.
You recently issued a press release saying that in the last year, food stamp usage has gone up 15% and welfare has only gone up 1%. Even though people are using up their unemployment benefits, people are getting poorer. What is in the obstacles in the way of people to getting welfare, and don't we need it more now than ever?
Well, we do, but I think the fundamental obstacle is the basic principles of the federal welfare law, which basically said to the states, the money we're going to give you, which we used to give you only to aid the poor, now, if you don't use that money to aid the poor, if you reduce your welfare rolls, you can use the money for other purposes. So that created a financial incentive for states to cut the welfare rolls willy-nilly and to reduce the real value of benefits in order to free up the federal dollars and the state dollars that used to go to poor people for other purposes. So it's just a very bad financial incentive, a federal financial incentive built into the federal welfare reform law. And unless and until the federal law is reformed to remove incentives that states then use to create barriers to keep needy people out of assistance, off the rolls, the situation is not going to improve. And the reality we're now facing is, of course, the federal welfare reform law has to be extended. And the unfortunate reality is, as bad as things are right now, things might actually get worse. During the recession, we've seen that the food stamp program, which has a much different federal law, a federal law that creates incentives to aid needy families, the food stamp program was very responsive to the recession. As unemployment rose, as poverty rose, the food stamp receipt rose significantly in a very responsive way. Whereas the increase in TANF rose, but a very small degree, far less than the increase in poverty, far less than the increase in unemployment, far less than the increase in food stamp receipt.
I just want to go back to the what is being strongly stated here, that the federal TANF policy actually incentivizes states to reduce aid to the poor.
Yes.
Just to expand on that a bit.
Well, the welfare program that existed pre-reform, the federal dollars that you got through the welfare program could only be used for aid to the poor. Under welfare reform, the federal dollars, which in theory you get through the welfare program, can be used for other purposes, for a variety of other social services. So if you can reduce your welfare program, which in many states is probably the least popular program, you free up the federal dollars for other purposes. And that's what we've seen all over the country.
And how did New York do that?
The mechanics of how states create barriers, you know, varies from state to state. But fundamentally, it means making the application process more difficult, making eligibility recertification more difficult, adopting sanctions policies that make it almost impossible for people who are trying to play by the rules to have their benefits continue, because so often the system generates error notices that result in people being sanctioned even though they've done nothing wrong. So you know, we've seen sanctions. We see sanctions on the increase all over the country. We see application barriers all over the country. We see benefits falling in real value all over the country.
Well, Tim, aside from these roadblocks that prevent or disqualify more of what are predominantly women from enrolling in TANF and or staying on TANF, I'm interested in some discussion about the issue of the mandatory work assignments, the federal policy that incorporated mandatory work assignments in TANF. How has that impacted, well, let's just say, women's opportunity to education or to, well, I guess it's institutionalized low wages, to put it mildly, or what we might call an indenture, really.
Yeah, prior to the welfare reform law, federal welfare policy had work requirements, but the requirements were structured so that women who did not have, for example, a high school diploma and who wanted to comply with the work requirements by finishing their high school education, or women who had a high school diploma but wanted to go to college and get it so they have an opportunity to get a real opportunity to get living wage employment, the federal welfare law, pre-welfare reform, allowed that. Under the current welfare law, under welfare reform, federal rules really make it very, very difficult, you know, for mothers who are receiving welfare assistance to go to school to complete their education. They sort of create a philosophy that's called work first, take any job at all, even if it, you know, barely pays minimum wage, has no benefits, has no vacation, has no sick pay, has no pension system, has no health insurance. So people get funneled out of welfare into low-wage women, you know, women's work, in quotes, that simply keeps them poor. And the lack of opportunity to complete their education, you know, leaves them in a situation where they'll remain in poverty for many, many years.
You know, I mean, with people falling off the unemployment rolls, you would think that this would be mentioned more and more because more and more people will be eligible, even though they may not be able to get welfare because of all these obstacles. And now it's going to be hopefully improved, but I can't see in this Congress and with this president. What do you see the future to be?
The most optimistic scenario at this point is for some modest improvements with maybe some additional federal dollars. The most realistic scenario at this point is probably continuation of the program with some new rules which will make even more onerous for poor families, even more difficult for families to get aid. Republicans now control the House, and the proposals that they've suggested so far are proposals that would make things worse for poor families. Prospects in the Senate, of course, are better, But the reality is a bill has to pass, you know, both houses of Congress. And at this point, there seems to be little support, virtually no support by the Republicans in the House, anything that would make kind of a better program for poor families.
You know, Tim Casey, one of the things that we both know is that the benefits received actually, which I'm not sure most people understand, still are far, far below the official poverty level to begin with. And one of the interesting and important issues here is the erosion of these benefits, the shredding of the safety net. What correlation does that have with women who are fleeing domestic violence or would have being forced to stay in an abusive situation?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, many of the women who turn to the welfare system, they do so because they're trying to escape from an abusive situation. So for many parents, you know, including my mother, when I was much younger than I am today, the welfare system was an escape hatch, a place you could turn to escape domestic violence. But now we hear so often stories where women, when they tried to, you know, get onto the welfare system, they were turned away and then faced with the choice of staying in or going back to a terrible situation or becoming homeless. So as the welfare system becomes more inaccessible and its benefits become more and more inadequate, more and more domestic violence victims are just faced with very difficult decisions about what to do. Because on the one hand, of course, they want to escape an abusive situation. On the other hand, they have to worry about how they meet their own and their children's basic needs.
Well, we never have enough time. But I do want to say that if you want more information on the End Poverty Now Coalition and the whole issue of TANF, which is so important, and yes, it's a major feminist issue. Tim Casey, what do we do?
Please go to our website, legalmomentum.org, and there's an awful lot of material that tells you more about our organization, about TANF, and about what you can do to help make TANF a better program.
So we've been speaking with attorney Tim Casey from Legal Momentum and long-term welfare advocate, and we better be as well. We are preparing to continue to all day, all night, all day, all week, occupy Wall Street. And another component part of Occupy Wall Street has been its support for working class, for workers' struggles in this city. Domino's Pizza moguls giddily reap profits off the backs of workers, watching their corporate sales surge to $1.57 billion in 2010. Patrick Doyle, Domino president, raked in $5.7 million in 2010, and Dave Melton's New York City's franchise had $4 million in yearly sales.
Meanwhile, Domino workers work up to 78 hours a week, but many are paid for only half of those hours at $4.40 an hour. Now that Domino workers are organizing, Domino, which refuses to comply with labor laws, is retaliating against the workers, but justice will be served.
We're joined by Pastor Robert Beshear from the Sweatshop Free New York campaign, and I know his church is also one of those that is providing sanctuary for our former encampers at Liberty Square, and Carlos Rodriguez of Justice Will Be Served, and Vincent Cao, also with Justice Will Be Served, and we have a translator, Thomas Keene. You know, we made one heck of a claim here that Domino Pizza kind of serves you with a smile, but really dishes out slavery. What does that really mean? Carlos?
Yes. Mi nombre es Carlos Rodriguez. Soy parte de la campaña Justicia Será Servida.
My name is Carlos Rodriguez. I'm a part of the Justice Will Be Served campaign.
Trabajador de Domino's Pizza, de la franquicia de Dave Melton.
I worked for the Domino's Pizza franchise of Dave Melton.
Yo en el 2007 fui al Departamento de Labor para quejarme de los malos tratos.
In 2007, I went to the Department of Labor to complain about the bad working conditions.
De los malos tratos de en Domino's Pizza que Dave Melton le da a sus trabajadores.
At the bad working conditions and mistreatment that Dave Melton gave to his workers at his franchise.
Yo me inspiré en la lucha de Saigon Grill.
The fight at Saigon Grill inspired me.
Un día andaba caminando por Upper West Side.
One day when I was walking through the Upper West Side.
Y miré que los trabajadores chinos estaban luchando por sus condiciones.
I saw Chinese workers protesting for the better conditions.
Entonces yo me organicé con mis compañeros y empezamos a luchar.
So I began organizing with my coworkers and we began to fight.
Hace un año que pusimos una demanda de acción colectiva.
It's been a year since we've put down a collective action lawsuit.
Este patrón, Dave Melton, él no ha mejorado condiciones, al contrario, los ha empeorado.
Dave Melton, he hasn't bettered conditions, he's actually made conditions worse.
Él está tomando represalia con trabajadores que estamos organizando, cortando horas.
He's taking retaliation against those workers who are organizing, cutting our hours.
El miércoles pasado hicimos una demostración en Upper West Side.
This past Wednesday we held a demonstration on the Upper West Side.
Empezamos un boicoteo a la ciudad entera de Nueva York.
And we began a citywide boycott in New York City.
Porque sabemos que la corporación tiene que tomar responsabilidad.
Because we know that the corporation has to take responsibility.
La corporación sabe que sus franquicias están explotando mucho a los trabajadores.
We know that the corporation knows its franchises are really exploiting its workers.
Ellos están haciendo millones de dólares a costa de nosotros los trabajadores sin recibir pago mínimo, no sobre tiempo.
They're making millions of dollars off of their workers, and workers aren't receiving minimum wage or overtime.
Le hacemos una invitación a todos los trabajadores de otras franquicias de Domino's Pizza a que salgan a luchar por sus condiciones.
We invite all other workers from other Domino's franchises, Domino's Pizza franchises, to come out and fight for their rights and for better conditions.
O que se unan a nosotros a la campaña Justicia Será Servida.
And that to unite with us in the Justice Will Be Served campaign.
Vincent, you're supporting the workers at Domino's, but you've got your own issues also. You're at Saigon Grill, so why don't you bring out some of those issues and then relate them to what's going on in Domino's?
Sure. I'm the Saigon Grill, the waiters. Since last year, we got fired because we speak out against age discrimination. The owner tried to fire the older workers.
Wait a minute. I must admit, looking at you, you look like you're about 25 years old.
Oh, they fired me not because of my own, but they tried to fire my coworker.
I see.
My coworker's 50 years old and 55 years old. They say that such old people, they cannot work here. And four younger workers speak out. Then we all get fired.
Wow.
All the workers, including the younger workers, who dare to speak up. Also, the delivery worker, they try to form the union because a lot of people losing jobs. They honor, you know, the illegal firing workers. When they try to form the union, they've been retaliated against. Recently, they just get fired because they complain about, you know, overtime, which is the owner say, oh, you guys so trouble. Just give me the letter to fire them. And we've been picketing, you know, Saigon Grill almost 1 year. I get involved because I was working at Midtown, 39th Street, another Chinese restaurant. And there's four more 36 delivery workers filed a lawsuit against Saigon Grill, former owner.
Mm.
At that time, my owner, you know, when I work in the 39th Street, my owner increased my wages. I have a better working condition. I didn't do anything. Because those workers stand up, fight for their right. And I know we should join. When I get involved with the Justice Will Be Served campaign, then the picket line become, you know, like to organize more workers participate. They, and we all know Saigon Grill and Domino Pizza are not the only sweatshop. A lot of sweatshops in New York City.
You've just given us the perfect segue to Father Brashear, who I know has been involved in the Sweatshop Free campaign on the Upper West Side. So why don't you contextualize some of what Vincent was saying for us and your work in support of these kinds of efforts?
Sure. What we were talking about last week at the rally was the fact that we do live in an age of Occupy, but we live out our own struggles for economic justice, not only in the halls of Congress or the chambers of City Hall, but in the neighborhoods where we live. And we also act out our actions for economic justice in 100 decisions we make every day in terms of where we buy our food, where we eat meals, where we order takeout from, where we get our nails done, where we buy our groceries. Every one of those decisions is a decision, a choice for or against economic justice. And the Sweatshop Free campaign in the Upper West Side began to try and introduce to people the idea that in our own neighborhood, we could create a sweatshop-free zone by those decisions and choices we make.
Carlos, describe more for us what your day-to-day life has been like as a worker for Domino.
Cuando me contrataron a mí para hacer delivery.
When they hired me to do delivery.
Ellos me contrataron solamente para hacer delivery, pero estando adentro, me forzaron a trabajar muchas horas sin pago de mínimo sobre tiempo.
They hired me, it was just supposed to be for delivery, but they forced me to work inside many hours without the right minimum wage or overtime.
Hacía el trabajo como de dos o tres personas.
I do the work of two or three people.
Cuando yo hablé, reclamé por mis derechos.
When I spoke up for my rights.
Ellos me despidieron.
They fired me.
And Carlos, what are the demands that you're making? What kinds of things do you want the public to do to help you? Is it a boycott just of the four stores that are owned by one franchisee or the entire cities? What do we do to help you in terms of Domino's?
No solo es el boycott de estas cuatro Domino's Pizza de Dave Melton. Es empezamos un boycott para toda la ciudad entera, todos los Domino's de Nueva York.
It's not just a boycott of these of this franchise of Dave Melton. It's a citywide boycott.
Las demandas que queremos es que cambie condiciones, que no viole las condiciones laborales.
Our demands are that they change working conditions, that they not violate the labor laws and conditions.
Que recontrate a los trabajadores que fueron votados por organizar.
That they rehire the workers who were fired for organizing.
Pagar las horas robadas que nos debe.
Pay the robbed hours that they owe to us.
And who do we complain to?
Yeah,
we need a number. We need to join a picket line. We need to take it right to Dave Melton. Who do we take it to? How?
Nos quejamos de Dave Melton, Angie Melton, y la corporación de Domino's Pizza, porque ellos saben lo que hacen sus franquicias.
He's saying we complain to Dave and Angie Melton and to the corporation because the corporation knows what's going on in its franchises.
Okay, we're going to find out more about that in a minute. But, Vincent, you and the work that you folks have been doing around the Saigon Grill and so on inspired Carlos. And we are beginning to occupy everywhere. Where are things at now with the Saigon Grill, and what do we also need to support yourself and the sacrifices you made to support your brothers, the waiters, who were let go from Saigon Grill?
So we're not going to separate, you know, like a Saigon Grill fight, Domino's fight, because this, you know, like in the past, the slaughter Domino pizza worker, they joined the Saigon Grill picking line. They not work at a Saigon Grill. But in the picking line, they met other restaurant worker, other background like drivers, nail salon worker, garment worker, construction worker. And picking line, you know, can help them to organize. That's why we have a huge rally, like a lot of workers come together. It's not just Domino pizza worker. So this, our workers struggle. So people should join, you know, as see as change, you know, working people. We can ask them to join the picking line. It's not like we want to have another rally, another huge demonstration. But more important, we get more workers to involve. Mm-hmm. You know, ask more workers to join.
One of the most exciting and beautiful things to see last week at the rally was that we had Chinese workers, we had Latino workers, and for the first time, French-speaking West African workers all joining together, going across different kinds of boundaries, ethnic, racial, cultural, and work, to come together to ask for justice. And what the public really needs to know is that these folks aren't asking for anything radical. They're not asking to overthrow a particular system. They're not even asking for a new law. All they're demanding is that the laws that currently exist be enforced and lived out. That's it.
Where am I going to go to do this? Because I want to join in with the workers that are organizing, which are also providing inspiration for, frankly, everybody who aspires to better wages and benefits and conditions for the 99% who create the wealth in this country. What do we do?
The first thing you do is to not buy Domino's pizza. The second thing you do is every Thursday night at Trinity Lutheran Church at 100th, right off of Amsterdam, there's a meeting that people from these unions come together to.
Tell us about these meetings. And
well, they're basically community meetings where basically people from the community who have, you know, been supporting, who have, you know, are part of the Sweatshop Free campaign, who have been supporting the fight of Saigon Grill and of Domino's, come together to plan out what are the next steps in mobilizing community members to spread the boycott, spread, you know, consciousness of what's going on with workers standing up across the Upper West Side.
And we hope, little by little, across the whole city, you'll see picket lines in front of your neighborhood Domino's. You can join in right in your own neighborhood.
And you can also Google Justice Will Be Served,
right,
the campaign, and they'll give an update on what's going on. Justice will be served.
This is all part of a Sweatshop Free campaign that is emanating from the Upper West Side and needs to spread throughout all of our communities. We have to occupy all of our communities with fair and just working conditions. We've got to support our brothers with Saigon Grill and our brothers with Domino Pizza. Boycott it until they enforce the labor laws.
As they said last week, no justice, no pizza.
Absolutely. One, two, three. What's that slogan?
No justice, no pizza.
All right. And we've been speaking. Thank you, Tom Keene, for translating, and Carlos Rodriguez with Justice Will Be Served, and Vincent Cao, Justice Will Be Served, and Pastor Robert Bashir for taking in folks and providing them with sanctuary and for educating us and taking up these working class issues. It is such a sparkling and exciting time, and you folks are tremendous catalysts for and stimulants for the working class. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.